May I invite you to seek your chair? We're a little bit late, if I compare it with the time schedule, but we had a wonderful lunch, and that's also, of course, networking is also very important. I hope you enjoyed lunch. And such a wonderful lunch has also, of course, one negative point, that afterwards you have to start all over again. So I hope, for sure, we all have the same dilemma in, going into the subject, but I hope and want to invite you to a very vibrant and dynamic discussion afterwards. I also discussed it already with the panelists, that we really would like to from this table to like the statements very short, and then afterwards invite you to join us in the discussion. And there's only one thing after listening this morning what I want to bring in before we start, and that's, of course, the general scope of this conference is human rights. And I agree, really agree, that this, at this moment, is the biggest challenge concerning migration. At the same time, we are faced in Europe with an increasing protectionism and nationalism from in the rich Western countries. And my opinion is that that has a great influence on the way we also deal with human rights and are able to find solution on this subject. And especially because of that, I'm very glad that not only in this room we have very beautiful experts, very wonderful and experienced experts, but also parliamentarians. And I really would like to, during this workshop, to invite also the politicians to bring in, from their perspective, what do they face if they look into the issue of migrants concerning human rights. So then we can have from more sides than only from the more technical side of human rights, looking for possibilities and hopefully also solutions. So that's what I wanted to say. I'm only here to do something about the structure. My name is Corinne Jonker. I'm replacing Mr. Dendias. I am the former chair of the Committee of Migration, Refugees and Populations in the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe. And next to that, I'm a Dutch politician. But it's not about me, and therefore I want to introduce you to our panelists. You also have the program. To my left, we have Arcadio Diaz Tejera. He's a colleague of mine in the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe and senator in Spain, and is judge. And to my right, we have Neil Folsom. Neil will also be rapporteur on this workshop. And he's the former UNHCR head of office in Malta, and at this moment he is lecturer human rights in Malta. And to the far right, Mr. Fernando de la Viter Nobre, and he is president of the International Medical Assistance, and I hope that I translated correct in correct English. Again, we are going to bring short statements, and then we enter into discussion with you. And of course, if there are questions after a certain statement, please raise your hand and you can bring forward your your remark or question. Yes? And then I'll give the floor to Mr. Diaz Tejera.
Buenas tardes. estoy muy interesado en responder o tratar de aportar algo a la pregunta ¿qué podemos hacer? Coincido con todo lo que se dijo esta mañana, con todo. También he de decir que en los últimos 20 años he escuchado lo que se dijo esta mañana. Y seguramente ustedes también habrán escuchado lo que yo vaya a aportar hoy. Porque los que estamos preocupados por estos asuntos llevamos escuchando estos discursos por aproximadamente unos 20 años. Antes que nada, agradecer a los organizadores que hayan hecho esta conferencia. Porque tan solo el que se haga esta conferencia ya es una manera de indicar cuál es el camino más adecuado. Una manera de reafirmar los derechos humanos es hacer esto. Si fuera una conferencia más acerca de cómo rentabilizar las cosas para enriquecernos más aún a costa de una parte de la población, pues sería una conferencia más al uso. Por el contrario, es una conferencia que yo creo que quiere reafirmar la necesidad de luchar por los derechos humanos y seguir distinguiendo lo que son las víctimas del tráfico de seres humanos, las víctimas en el ámbito del fenómeno poblacional de la migración, de lo que son los criminales. Son dos ámbitos distintos que conviene subrayar. Si ustedes evalúan el ordenamiento jurídico internacional, verán que textos desde el año 58, la Convención de Ginebra de abril sobre el derecho del mar, textos del año 89, el Convenio de Salvamento Marítimo, el Acuerdo de Montego Bay de 1982 de Jamaica, o más recientemente el Convenio de Palermo con sus tres protocolos, el tráfico de personas, el tráfico de migrantes y el tráfico de armas. Si hacen una evaluación del conjunto del ordenamiento jurídico vinculado al derecho marítimo, yo diría que tenemos un ordenamiento jurídico bastante avanzado. Pero el asunto, creo, no está en la necesidad de nuevas normas, porque creo que el subsistema del ordenamiento jurídico relativo al derecho marítimo, creo que es un buen subsistema de derecho marítimo internacional. Luego, lo que planteo aquí es una tesis poco común entre los juristas, porque en general nos creemos el ombligo del universo y pensamos que la vida la cambiamos haciendo nuevas leyes. Yo lo que trato de plantear aquí no es un razonamiento propio del sistema jurídico continental, que sería el portugués, el italiano, el alemán, el español, sino bien un razonamiento más bien propio del sistema jurídico anglosajón, que trata de ver de qué manera, con el actual sistema jurídico, con las actuales normas, se trata solo de interpretarlas de una forma que más se acomode a la realidad social de lo que estamos viviendo. Es decir, esta mañana le preguntaba a algún miembro de la mesa, concretamente le preguntaba al jurista, al miembro del Tribunal Europeo de Derechos Humanos de Estrasburgo, le preguntaba si en su opinión cabe una interpretación del artículo 98 y el artículo 110 del convenio de Montego Bay de Jamaica, el de 1982, si cabe una interpretación de tal forma que el concepto del derecho de visita del artículo 110 y lo previsto en el artículo 98 cuando hay un peligro inminente y hay que salvaguardar la vida de los ocupantes de la nave, si se podría interpretar de tal forma que no cupiese posibilidad alguna de pérdida de seres humanos en los esfuerzos que hacen por dejar la miseria, el hambre, la persecución, incluso la migración climática, que muchas veces hemos trabajado en la comisión, en el Comité de Migración, Refugiados y Población del Consejo de Europa, y tratan de organizar su derecho a la esperanza. Entonces, lo que yo planteo aquí es que si la política y el Estado está perdiendo la batalla con respecto a los mercados en el ámbito financiero, y no se atreven los Estados a poner un impuesto sobre la especulación financiera, mañana entra en vigor aquí un nuevo impuesto que en total realidad también afecta a los capitales por encima de 150.000 euros. Bien, si en ese ámbito de la crisis económica la política y el Estado está a la defensiva, sorteando los puñetazos que le está dando el mercado, en el ámbito de los movimientos migratorios, que son unos movimientos humanos que nos van a acompañar toda la vida de todos los que estamos aquí presentes en esta reunión, la tesis es que estamos perdiendo la batalla. La política, el Estado y el derecho están perdiendo la batalla. Porque los gobiernos tienen que pensar en automantenerse y cuidar el sistema de votación. Luego, las respuestas nacionales son respuestas de bloqueo, pero las necesidades de los movimientos humanos son respuestas de apertura, porque necesitan, insisto, organizar su derecho a la esperanza. Entonces, las respuestas que ha habido hasta ahora, por ejemplo, con el sistema Frontex, ¿acabo ya? ¿Tengo que acabar?
No, finish.
Finish. One minute only? Yes. El sistema Frontex es un sistema necesario, es bueno. En mi opinión, hay que potenciarlo, fortalecerlo muchísimo más. Muchísimo más, porque salva vidas. Y lo que, en mi opinión, se plantea es, a los hombres y mujeres que prestan servicio en el sistema Frontex hay que mimarlos, quererlos, potenciarlos, apoyarlos y dotarlos de buenos presupuestos. Y la interpretación, la reinterpretación del subsistema del ordenamiento jurídico internacional vinculado al derecho marítimo, en mi opinión, hay que hacerla de tal forma que por encima de todo salvaguardemos al máximo el derecho a la esperanza que tienen el conjunto de seres humanos que nos devuelven ahora la visita que en su día hicieron nuestros bisabuelos. Estaría muy interesado en seguir hablando 5 horas más, pero por respeto a la presidenta me callo. Muchas gracias, señora presidenta.
Thank you very much, Mr. Díaz Tejera. Then I now would like to give the floor to Mr. Fernando de la Fite Nobre. You have the floor.
Bom, boas tardes a todos. Muito obrigado pelo convite. Como é um prazer estar aqui. Está aqui a falar um médico que atua há mais de 30 anos no campo humanitário e cada vez que assiste a uma conferência sobre este tema, como sobre outros, como médico penso. Nós estamos perante uma situação onde o diagnóstico está feito, sabemos as causas que levam à doença que estamos a enfrentar, sabemos as consequências que essa doença pode provocar cá na Europa e lá nos países de partida, e sabemos quais as terapêuticas, as soluções que existem para podermos pôr fim a esse flagelo dos direitos humanos. Cada vez que estou no Senegal, em Yoff, ao pé do aeroporto de Dakar, e que vejo partir canoas em destino às Canárias, é esse pensamento que eu tenho sempre. O que é que está a acontecer? Porque, sabendo e o diagnóstico estando feito, porque é que não se adaptam as medidas adequadas para talvez podermos travar esse fenómeno? Porque todos nós sabemos que esse movimento migratório vai tomar amplitudes muito maiores do que as atuais. Eu lembro-me que há uns 10 anos, em Washington, estive com o então presidente da OCDE, o Sr. Roger Bovin, e ele dizia-me que por volta de 2025, 2030, quer dizer, amanhã já, iríamos ter uma corrente migratória sul-norte como nunca vista na humanidade. Uma corrente migratória como nunca antes observada na história da humanidade. E porquê, dizia eu? Porque a África subsaariana, a África negra, ia ter no mercado de trabalho mais jovens do que o Canadá, mais os Estados Unidos da América, mais a União Europeia, mais a Rússia e mais o Japão. E se nós sabemos o que está a ser preparado, as causas de todos esses refugiados, nós sabemos quais são. Eu recolhi ali na mesa um documento que é a Resolução 1637 de 2008 e tudo já está aqui escrito. Tudo o que se possa dizer, além do que já está aqui escrito, é, quanto a mim, redundância. Então, se nós sabemos as causas do fenómeno, Se nós sabemos as consequências que esse fenómeno vai ter nos países de imigração e nos países de emigração. E se nós sabemos as soluções que temos para tratar o fenómeno, porquê que não as aplicamos? As soluções, quanto a mim, enquanto médico humanitário, é essencialmente uma. É procurarmos soluções de verdadeiro desenvolvimento local nos países de partida. Não é financiar projetos megalomânicos aos governos, é criar condições de vida adequadas e satisfatórias junto das populações rurais. Porque vou-me concentrar apenas na África subsaariana, onde eu nasci e conheço particularmente bem, penso eu. A África subsaariana está em movimento para os portos da Mauritânia e do Senegal, para os portos de Marrocos, para os portos da Tunísia, para os portos da Líbia. Eles querem chegar até nós porque nos seus países, vítimas da corrupção, do subdesenvolvimento crónico, dos conflitos diversos, da falta de esperança, da falta de trabalho, eles não podem continuar a viver. E os povos puseram-se sempre em movimento quando entenderam que a sua sobrevivência estava em causa. Por isso, nós temos que efetivamente implementar projetos de desenvolvimento nos seus países e nós temos que criar as condições objetivas que permitam, quando eles chegam até nós, que os respeitos humanos, que os direitos humanos sejam efetivamente respeitados. Nós estamos, agora permitam-me uma metáfora enquanto cirurgião que eu sou, nós estamos numa situação de hérnia estrangulada. Um cirurgião que não opera uma hérnia estrangulada é um incompetente, que já não pode operar mais. O que é que estão a fazer? A nossa liderança política europeia, a nossa liderança global, que sem sensibilidade, sem vontade, sem capacidade e sem determinação, não enfrentam o que vai ser um dos maiores desafios da humanidade. Não tenhamos medo de o afirmar. Isso é a grande interrogação que eu tenho permanentemente em mim. Nós vamos ter que enfrentar um dos maiores desafios da humanidade que se vai agravar com a questão das alterações climáticas, a questão do não combate efetivo contra a fome, a questão do não alcance das metas dos objetivos do milénio, sobretudo na África subsaariana. E por isso o desenho já está mais do que feito. Resta atuar. Conversa, reuniões, pese embora o seu interesse sempre, tudo já é sabido. Nós temos agora que atuar e atuar rapidamente para que esses milhares de pessoas que morrem nos trajetos para chegar até nós, ou pela via transatlântica para as Canárias, ou pela via transmediterrânica para a Itália, para a Grécia, para a Espanha, ou pela via transsaariana para chegar até à Tunísia e à Líbia, nós temos que fixar as populações para que eles não tenham mais vontade nem necessidade de partirem. É isso o fundamental. Poderia dizer muito mais está aqui, mas eu entendo que o momento das decisões chegou. Nós, e agora atuo enquanto cidadão, nós vamos ter que fazer a pressão suficiente nos nossos governos para que as medidas sejam atuadas e que uma verdadeira ajuda ao desenvolvimento se faça, e nós sabemos que ela está a diminuir, e para que nós possamos aceitar entre nós esses imigrantes em condições humanas, porque nós sabemos o que está em causa é, nos seus países de origem, um agravado subdesenvolvimento com essa fuga de quadros, e nos nossos países, uma agravada xenofobia, do racismo e talvez um problema quanto ao futuro das nossas democracias. E pronto, fica dito o que eu penso. Muito obrigado.
Thank you very much. Are there already questions or remarks you want to make? Mr. Wille from Belgium, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure if some of you will like what I will say, but I feel the need to say, so I will say.
Paul, may I interrupt you only shortly? Mr. Neil Folsom will also have a statement, so I don't know if it's a short remark on what is already set, or do you want to start a discussion already?
It's a more general one, but feel free to say when I can say what I want to say.
Okay. Yes, you have. Yes.
I have a feeling that since the morning I'm in a virtual meeting, because as a politician, as a senator of Belgium, I am agreeing on most of what has been said today. And in my voting in the last 25 years, I have been in that logic. But apparently there is a problem, especially when I hear the last gentleman speak about politicians without any sensitivity. I would like to issue a warning. We are politicians without backing for what you are all saying since the morning. With me you will have no problem, but most probably I will be replaced by people who share much less the type of reasoning as you are holding it since the morning. Because you are all a little bit of fatalists. You are speaking about migration, about a fatal fact. Whereas the public opinion in our countries, I'm speaking from Belgium, but we have been working in the Council of Europe since a number of years. I've been presiding a commission on trafficking for 10 years. I can tell you that the evolution in the public opinion in our countries is that the politicians should be strong enough not to accept it as a fatal fact, but to fight in a just way, also a humanitarian way, to make sure that this migration is not taking place. It is, by ways of speaking, the same engine, but the electricity comes from an other energy source. So if I'm not saying what I feel, I would feel unhappy about not saying that. Now at least I've said what I think of being a certain utility. And I'm most open to the further the discussion, but I needed to say that.
Okay. Thank you very much. But maybe already Mr. Lavie-Tenobre, do you want to respond on it, or we wait until the discussion? Okay. Then I'll first give the floor to Neil Folsom. Neil, you have the floor.
Thank you. I was asked to give a very brief presentation on interception and related issues. And what I will do is I will try to bring to your attention a bit of the practical experience I had whilst working on the little island Malta in the middle of the Mediterranean, and how human rights issues intertwine with interception and other maritime law situations. For those people who aren't very well aware of what we talk about when we speak about refugees taking a maritime voyage, I'll try to give you an idea of what we're talking about, to give an idea of the general scenario. Essentially what we're speaking about is boats leaving a third country in an attempt to reach either EU territory or territory of a Council of Europe state. The reasons for leaving, and therefore the people present on the boats, are often very, very varied, as we mentioned this morning. On boats, you often have refugees, environmental refugees, economic migrants, victims of trafficking, and persons leaving for many other reasons. You also have a variety of women, men, children, pregnant women, elderly persons, disabled persons. So the idea is that on the boats trying to reach Europe, you have a very big variety of persons leaving for very different reasons. With particular reference to persons fleeing the country, a number of elements are very important to understand the route and to understand why interception has such huge consequences on a human rights debate. We're speaking about persons who cannot find protection in their home country, and more importantly, could not find protection in a country of transit, a country they were crossing whilst trying to reach safety. In the case of Malta and Italy, we are primarily speaking about North African countries, for example, Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya. So there's a lack of protection along the way in an attempt to reach Europe. This gives rise to what is known as secondary movements, persons who feel the need to constantly keep moving because they cannot find human rights protection in any given country that they are crossing. And this is why, henceforth, the need to keep on the voyage. Another point which was mentioned this morning, which is also very important, is that in most cases, these attempts for accessing the Council of Europe territory or EU territory are often irregular. primarily because most persons fleeing the whole countries are simply not in a position to access the territory in a regular manner. A very straightforward example. There is no way a Somali refugee leaving Somalia will be given a Schengen visa to access the European Union. That's a very practical example to highlight why irregular entry is, in many cases, the only means of entry. What usually happens out at sea, and this is where we come to interception, the topic of this workshop, is either because of a fault on the boat or for another other reasons, climatic conditions, the persons on the boat either launch an SOS to their friends or to the governments within the region, Malta, Italy, Spain, wherever, or they are intercepted out at sea, and that is where the whole debate starts. And this is where I'd like to focus what exactly happens. In terms of the legal environment in which all these things happen, and I'll just repeat a few words mentioned by my colleague, the legal framework we are talking about is a very clear legal framework. The law of the sea is very clear on the duty of governments and the duty of any vessel out at sea to rescue any person in distress. This is a duty which binds governments and also private vessels, the duty to rescue anyone in distress. So they already have an international duty. Together with this duty, there's also the 1951 Refugee Convention that plays in this legal scenario. You also have the European Convention on Human Rights and related protocols that also have a say in what happens out at sea. And obviously now you also have applicable European Union law, various directives, the Schengen Border Codes, hopefully the Charter of Fundamental Rights and other documentation. So the legal regime is there, and it's a rather complicated one. In terms of the human rights concerns about what happens out at sea, this is where the problems actually arise. The problems with interception are, you have a varied interpretation and ratification by governments of the various international maritime law instruments. A very practical example is Malta-Italy situation, where the two governments have ratified different maritime law conventions and different amendments, resulting in a situation that when faced with a boat out at sea, there's often a dispute amongst the governments on which government is about to take responsibility for the particular boat. Both governments are legitimate in claiming the rights they are claiming, because both governments, as sovereign governments, have a right to ratify any kind of convention and any kind of amendment that they please. So it's not possible for us to blame particular governments for ratifying different legislation. But the problem is a very real one. All of you must definitely remember the famous tuna pen incidents, where you had a number of refugees floating aboard the tuna pens. This is because Italy and Malta ratified different conventions and different levels of the convention, and they couldn't agree on who to take responsibility for. You also have the problem of the extraterritorial application of governments' human rights obligations. Governments most willingly accept human rights obligations within their territory. The problem arises where the human rights situation is found outside their territory, on the high seas. So again, the legal argument is, do the obligations apply? If they do apply, to whom do they apply? And to what extent do they apply? Does non-refoulement apply on the high seas? If so, what does it mean in actual fact? You also have a problem that under international maritime law, the duty to rescue persons in distress attaches with it the duty to take the person to a port of safety. The problem is that the definition of port of safety is not found anywhere. And different governments give different interpretations to what they understand as being a safe port. Some governments limit the interpretation to safety from a maritime perspective, so climatic and that kind of, and security-related security issues. From a human rights perspective, what we would try to advocate for is a safety which also includes the safety in the case of asylum seekers. Safety meaning a place where they would have access to an effective asylum procedure and where their rights would be fully respected. You also have the problem, and I'm coming to an end, you also have the problem of an increased tendency within the European Union and also therefore affecting the Council of Europe territory of an externalization of asylum obligations. The tendency to create an asylum bracket just outside EU territory, a and governments willingly boarding over their asylum obligations onto such territories, and therefore the pressure at EU level, on a high political level, to enforce and to strengthen the asylum capacity of third countries at the border of the European Union. The risk in this, obviously, and links to interception, is that if you do return asylum seekers to a place where they would not have access to a very efficient and effective asylum procedure, as for example is Libya, you run the risk of having direct or indirect refoulement, and also a breach of various provisions of the European Convention, Article 3, for example. And this is just to summarize how I see human rights concerns interspersed with interception issues. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think now Mr. De La Vite Nobre wants to respond, I think, to what Mr. Wille said already. You have the floor.
Eu quero responder à senhora. Eu vivi 20 anos na Bélgica, em Bruxelas. Por lá eu fiz todos os meus estudos, dos 15 aos 34 anos. Conheço muito bem a Bélgica. Se bem, por outro lado, tenho família holandesa, do lado da minha mãe, daí os nomes estrangeiros estão aí no meio do meu nome. Você vê qual é a pressão que as populações da Europa estão a fazer junto dos seus políticos e dos seus governantes. Querem que sejam mais duros e flexíveis, sem dúvida. Mas cabe também aos políticos, aos responsáveis dos nossos países, ter uma função pedagógica, é explicar a razão desses movimentos. O que eu disse, e insisto, é que nós estamos perante um desafio que vai tomar proporções muito maiores do que as atuais. Nós só temos uma maneira de trabalhar com esse desafio. É criar as condições para que as populações não tenham razões objetivas para saírem dos seus países. Nenhum desses refugiados, desses imigrantes por razões económicas, seja por que razões forem, saem dos seus países sem uma razão. E nós sabemos, e eu, enfim, falo mais do continente africano, mas podia fazer falar da Ásia Meridional ou de alguns países da América Latina, nós sabemos, no que diz respeito à África subsaariana, que o desespero está lá instalado. Nós sabemos, infelizmente, as tendências atuais irão agravar o fenómeno. A crise financeira de 2008, dados do Banco Mundial, provocou apenas e só mais 100 milhões de pobres. Nós sabemos que as razões que fazem as pessoas partirem são razões objetivas. Nós temos que criar as condições nesse país e junto a esses governos para que isso não aconteça, para que nós possamos travar o fenómeno. Porque, pese embora toda a legislação e bem que está a ser produzida no nosso país para poder receber, enfim, com o menor traumatismo possível, esses refugiados ou imigrantes económicos, nós sabemos que a tendência vai se agravar. Nós estamos a lutar contra uma onda que vai ter cada vez maiores proporções. Temos que ir às causas. Como o médico falou, não vale a pena tratar apenas os sintomas. Temos que tratar as causas.
Ok, I would like to ask the panelists and also the participants to make short statements or questions. Mr. Diaz-Tijera also wants to add something. 2 minutes, please.
Gracias, Presidenta. Un dato optimista. En esta Convención de Naciones Unidas contra la Delincuencia Transnacional Organizada, que antes les decía, del año 2000 de Palermo, de sus tres protocolos, el tráfico de personas, el tráfico de migrantes y el tráfico de armas, en este apartado 1, el tráfico de personas, el artículo 3.A, incorpora algo que a mí me parece novedoso, que es, a la hora de proteger a las víctimas, considera irrelevante el consentimiento. Y a mí eso me parece una gran conquista jurídica, el que esa persona haya consentido en vivir esa situación, en que haya consentido la condición de víctima en el tráfico de seres humanos, el que haya consentido, se entiende que está en la situación de violencia, que hay un vicio de nulidad de esa voluntad, y por lo tanto, aunque haya consentido, el hecho delictivo sigue existiendo. A mí eso me parece un dato relevante y quiero ponerlo de manifiesto para compensar los comentarios que antes hacía. Segunda cosa, en otro taller se está trabajando sobre la realidad de presos en dentro de Europa que no han cometido ningún hecho delictivo, tan solo no tener los papeles en regla, pero son presos porque se les impide su libertad de circulación y de deambulación. Tercera cosa, el asunto del Marine 1, para comentar la intervención del compañero. Era un buque lleno de 300 asiáticos, no tenía pabellón, no tenía bandera, no tenía matriculación. El convenio de Montego Bay prevé que si no tiene pabellón, no tiene matrícula, pues entonces sí, se ejerce el artículo, tanto el 110 como el 98. Acabo ya. Y entonces, hay varias sentencias, la 561, 582, 554 y la 618 del año 2007, del Tribunal Supremo de Peña, que lo que plantea es que al llevar a esos emigrantes al lugar más cercano, en el caso de Mauritania, la responsable era la autoridad efectiva que estaba a cargo de esa responsabilidad. En este caso se planteó un problema jurídico. Y acabo ya. Dos cosas. El día que los emigrantes voten, supongo yo que avanzaremos bastante ahí. Y una última cosa. No es bueno satanizar a nadie, pero ciertamente con una mayor voluntad jurídica, supongo que el derecho estaría un poquito más engrasado. Nada más.
Thank you. I have still interpretation on my mic. I want to give you the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will try to be brief, but it's really difficult because we've already touched upon a lot of issues. We're dealing with human beings, and I think this is the key issue. Is it okay? Okay. I'll try to stand closer. Madam Chairman, I said it's difficult to be brief because we've already touched upon many issues. We are dealing with issues that deal with human beings. And when we deal with human beings, it's very difficult to be rational and not to be emotional. But I think precisely because lives are at stake, we need to be rational because we need to find solutions. Now, I must say, I was very surprised to hear the panelists talk about environmental refugees and economic refugees. Madam Chairman, this is a fiction in terms of the law. There is no such thing as an environmental refugee. There is no such thing as an economic refugee. And I was very surprised to hear the former representative of UNHCR use this term, precisely because I read a paper signed by Mr. Gutierrez. And Mr. Gutierrez says, please do not use the word environmental refugees. It is very, the intentions are good, but the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And the use of this phrase, which has become unfortunately very popular, is actually detrimental to the rights of real asylum seekers. We have refugees, we have asylum seekers, and we have people who are entitled to humanitarian protection. So please, first, an issue of precision. Second, we've talked about my Belgian colleague, and I have to align myself to a certain point with him, talks about this confrontational attitude that sometimes, and I think part of this conference, if for nothing else, it should serve to bring us together. We're all in this together. We need to find solutions. There is a lot of goodwill from EU member states. But unfortunately, when I read the Parliamentary Assembly report, sometimes I see where the good intentions are. I see that the Parliamentary Assembly is finding the lacunas and identifying the problems. But, for instance, I was very happy to hear Mr. Diaz Tejera talk about Frontex in a positive light, because I read the motion, the two motions that led to what will now be your report on the interception. And I must say, certain terminology used, such as the contemplation of the liquidation of Frontex, is not very helpful. Particularly when 1 year prior to your motion, we had a report, Europe's boat people, which talks very highly. There are issues with Frontex, we are aware. Going back to the issues between member states, let us not be sensationalists. That is why, in the beginning of my intervention, I appealed about the need to have a rational approach in what are very delicate human situations.
we highlight the times that Malta and Italy have had disputes. But let us be honest. Malta and Italy cooperate in thousands of search and rescue operations. And overall, the picture is not so bad. Now, I understand every life, every human being is a human being, and we cannot joke. But I am very much aware of the problems of interpretation between Malta and Italy, and I'm sure you are aware of the reasons of why Malta is hesitant to accept certain amendments that have been passed at the convention. And at the end of the day, I repeat the intervention that I made in the plenary. Let us not. There is a big space over here, and I see a big elephant. I don't know if you are aware of the English expression, the elephant in the room. There is a big elephant in the room. There is an issue that nobody wants to talk about. My last comment, I apologize, but I understand, Madam Chair. There is a big issue that nobody wants to talk about. The issue of solidarity and burden sharing. I can list, but I will not take your time. I have them here. A list of statements in which all the major stakeholders talk about the need for, the entire community to deal with these issues collectively, but there is no will. And that is why Malta and Italy have problems, not really because of the issues of interpretations really are issues of logistics. Thank you. And
thank
I apologize
you very much.
For my long
it's not that I want to take but I think also later on in the discussion you can again participate. Göran Lindblad, parliamentarian from Sweden.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Well, for me as a parliamentarian and a human being, I think it's important to step out of the bureaucratic box. We are talking about human beings. This is not an issue where we should be rational and not emotional. Every tragedy with every death or every casualty of a human being is important to deal with. Therefore, we must face up to reality and not fiction. And of course there are environmental refugees and there are economic refugees even if they're not formally a decision taken that they are existing, but they are there. So let's face that. And of course help locally is very good, but we do have to take responsibility for those that we cannot help locally. People will try to find their future somewhere else as long as the situation locally is not good enough. And when it comes to refugees, when it comes to migrants, the remittances they're sending home, the sum of the remittances is much larger than the foreign aid that the European Union is sending to the countries concerned. So that helps a lot more locally than the foreign aid. And of course, without a free movement and without a free migration, there is stagnation. Had we not had the migration over the thousands of years in Europe, for example, we would be a much more boring place, and we would be a place without any development. Actually, I asked for the floor when Mr. Folson was speaking and talking about interception at sea. And of course, you mentioned that this is formally what we can do and cannot do. For me as a parliamentarian, then if there are formal problems, then we have to change it. Then there is legislation that we have to do. We shall not just look away and say, this is formally what we can do. Then we have to take the responsibility and actually do it. And you mentioned Libya as a not safe home. Well, we have other places where the detention centers are pretty bad. We sent some refugees back to Greece, and the situation there was terrible. It was all
Mr.
over
Lindblad.
The Swedish elevation, as well as Malta,
sure,
and as
please.
Well as Italy. And that's the end of it. Thank
okay.
you, Madam Chair.
Scandinavians know, as Dutch people, how to know to be sure. So please stick to our time, then a lot of people can add to this discussion. First, I want to give the floor to Mr. Beer and back to Malta, because I can expect that you want a response on something Mr. Lindblad has said. Mr. Beer, UNHCR.
Sorry. Non, je voulais juste rappeler que le principe, on l'a dit, d'extraterritorialité s'applique dans tous les cas. La majorité des États européens, membres du Conseil de l'Europe, ont ratifié la Convention de 1951. Ils ont ratifié également d'autres instruments. Donc, en effet, on parle d'êtres humains. Et je pense qu'il est important de rappeler quand même, même lorsqu'on parle d'êtres humains et lorsqu'on parle des enjeux politiques, qu'il est important de rappeler, c'est ce qu'on a dit en début de matinée, qu'il faut toujours avoir une approche basée sur les droits. Donc il y a assez d'instruments juridiques qui disent qu'on ne peut pas renvoyer des personnes vers des pays où leur vie est à risque, ou des endroits où ils pourraient être soumis à la torture, etc. Donc ça, je pense que c'est un point clair sur lequel nous devons nous mettre d'accord. Deuxièmement, je voudrais dire également, comme on l'a dit ce matin, qu'il y a une variété de personnes sur ces bateaux. Il y a des femmes, des enfants, des vieillards, il y a des personnes qui viennent pour des raisons différentes, et il y a des personnes qui viennent pour demander l'asile. La responsabilité partagée, nous avons abordé ces questions ce matin, la chaire a rappelé que l'Union européenne doit faire plus d'efforts pour une responsabilité partagée. Mais même si l'on fait plus d'efforts, cela n'empêche que chaque État doit respecter ses obligations. Point 1. Point 2. Même si l'on fait plus d'efforts, l'accès à l'asile, ce n'est pas juste mettre 2-3 personnes dans une opération pour qu'une personne puisse faire une demande d'asile. Il faut en plus que cela puisse être un réel accès à l'asile. Si vous vous trouvez sur un bateau, fatigué, désespéré, après avoir traversé je ne sais combien de pays, après avoir été battu, violé ou toutes sortes de choses comme nous l'avons vu sur le terrain, nous autres personnes du HR, je ne pense pas que vous soyez dans l'état même de demander l'asile, et on ne peut pas après dire que vous n'avez pas demandé l'asile pour vous renvoyer. Il faut mettre en place, et je vais terminer par cela, Madame la Présidente, il faut mettre en place des procédures efficaces pour permettre aux personnes d'accéder à l'asile, compte tenu des circonstances dans lesquelles elles sont lorsqu'on les trouve sur les bateaux qui sont interceptés en mer. Je vous remercie.
Okay, thank you very much. Going back to Malta.
Again, going back to the issue of refugees, in response to Mr. Lindland, nobody is saying that economic migrants do not have rights, but there is a hierarchy of rights. What I am trying to say is that someone who has left Tunisia because he wants to have a better economic situation is different to a woman who has seen her family shot in front of her very own eyes. So please, let us not put the situation of a Somali woman who is seriously, who has seen her family killed in front of her eyes in the same boat, to use the analogy, of someone who wants a better economic situation. And you are not having an argument with me, you are having an argument with Mr. Gutierrez. I am simply repeating what Mr. Gutierrez warns against this well-intended, the issue is one of logistics. If a country is receiving in 1 week 1,000 people, that country has to prioritize. And we can sit in this room and dream and talk and go back to our comfortable offices. But at the end of the day, we have to help human beings. And in order to help human beings, we have to make difficult choices. Thank you.
I saw somebody wanting to take the floor. Yes, you have the floor.
Good morning. Sorry, I am the... My name is Claudio Petrocello. I am an Italian liaison officer here in Lisbon for anti-drug matter. I am here representing MAOC, Maritime Analysis Operations Center. We are engaged more with anti-drug matters, but interception at sea, it's really something interesting. Si vous permettez, j'essaye à continuer en français dans l'espoir de pouvoir mieux m'expliquer. On est en train de parler d'interception en mer, mais j'aimerais savoir l'opinion de toute la platée sur quel est le but de l'interception. Il me semble de comprendre qu'on n'est pas en train de parler en interdiction, en interception, comme on peut assumer dans les problèmes de la drogue, où on vise à saisir la drogue. Ici, on est seulement en chercher d'intercepter les bateaux pour après sauver les gens qui sont dessus. Donc on a un système comme Frontex qui cherche les bateaux en mer, pas pour les rejeter à la frontière, parce qu'on n'est pas en train de parler de ça, c'est même pas pensable de faire quelque chose du genre. Donc c'est pour aller chercher des gens désespérés au milieu de la mer, pour l'amener dans les pays frontalières où on doit s'en occuper, voire aller comment les traiter, donner un statut, chercher à résoudre les problèmes, les renvoyer dans leur pays si les conditions qu'on a vues jusqu'à maintenant c'est correct. Il me semble qu'en extrême synthèse, la situation c'est celle-là. Et si c'est celle-là, il me semble que c'est un petit peu trop fort pour les pays comme Malte, comme l'Italie, comme l'Espagne, qui sont les pays frontaliers avec l'Afrique. C'est seulement pour demander votre opinion.
Thank you. Somebody special you want to add this question to?
No, I would like to open this discussion because we are talking about European methods, but if we follow the step, is Spain, Malta, Italian and Greece problem. And more we speak about humanitarian rights, and more we focus on that problem.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Peter from Benjamin Fabi from SAFE. I have a few questions. Do you
mind? Sorry. Maybe it's only me, but I didn't understand what you represent.
Center for European and International Policy Action.
Okay, thank you very much.
It's on the paper, if you want to read. So I have a few questions to the complex of asylum, to you, Madam Chairman and Chairwoman, and to the speakers. The one is because this conference is addressing the human rights. So asylum, first question, would the asylum support office and the new EU resettlement policy improve the human rights of refugees and asylum seekers? This is the first question. Second one, just a comment. I mean, our government and I have to say, Paul Willer, also our politicians, they don't take up necessarily always the human rights of those who have been rejected from the asylum system. And there is a big sort of question for our future. Second complex of questions, what do the speakers think as regarding the European migration policy? Do we have to introduce the point system, the quota? Does the blue card, which has been approved, adopted and taken in the Council, the European Council, by all of our 27 member states, represent a sufficient method to furnish our migration policies and human rights? So those are my questions, please.
Okay. Thank you very much, and then I'll give you the floor.
My name is Nils Moisnex. I'm the chairman of the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance, which is the Council of Europe's racism monitoring body. I don't want to speak on detention at sea, although I'm very curious to hear a panelist's views on, are there issues regarding racism and racial discrimination that arise on matters pertaining to detention at sea, because this is something that the Commission is asked to comment on increasingly, and we're having to formulate our own opinion on this. I wanted to briefly comment on politicians, the role of politicians and the debate on migration and asylum and refugees. I think a major, and I say this also as a former politician, the problem that we see in many countries in Europe is that the only voices that are often heard on issues relating to migration, asylum, and refugees is extreme right. Other voices are silent. The extreme right, or the populist right, they have a stand. They have a program, and they care intensely about this issue. Very often what we see is that moderate politicians do not have a stand, or they do not want to take a stand on this issue. They do not counter demagoguery, stereotypes, exaggerations, falsity, and we see only one spectrum of the debate, and that is affecting and taking over the mainstream debate. We do not hear the human rights-based arguments in the debate on migration and asylum. We don't hear about not only the challenges of immigrant integration, but the success stories. And I think this is a big problem. We need to reclaim the debate from only one end of the political spectrum, and which is very difficult to do, because there are not a lot of votes to be had in it. But I think that I agree with the panelists that education, we need to educate the electorate, but we also have to educate the electorate about the very difficult trade-offs that face European, yes, I'm last sentence, that face us all, and also about the share of the burden that our countries need to assume in this broader process which affects us all. But I will speak more on this tomorrow.
Thank you very much. Mr. Díaz-Tejera?
Gracias, Presidenta. Dentro de dos años, acabaré mi trabajo como senador y volveré a poner sentencias como juez. Algunas de ellas sentencias sobre los patrones de los cayucos que llegaban al archipiélago canario. Pero a lo largo de este tiempo de experiencia como senador, la idea que tengo de los políticos en general, siempre hay excepciones, pero en general, la idea que tengo de los políticos no es especialmente mala. Como tampoco la tengo especialmente buena de los jueces, o de los astronautas, los buzos o los capadores de abejas. De todo hay en todo tipo de actividades. Lo que quiero plantear es que pienso que hay un esfuerzo de buena voluntad de la gente que están aquí y que vienen a este tipo de conferencias y que están en el Consejo de Europa. Se trata de ir explicando que en el año 2050 los europeos necesitaremos 70 millones de migrantes más. En el año 2050, para mantener el estado de bienestar que tenemos ahora en la Europa del bienestar, necesitamos 70 millones de emigrantes más, porque si no, no lo podemos mantener, dada la distribución de la población, la pirámide de la población y la escasa cantidad de nacimiento de niños y el aumento de la longevidad. Segunda cosa. Tercera cosa. Lo relevante no es el debate académico acerca de las categorías. Porque cuando un subsahariano prefiere morir en esa autopista de la muerte desde África a Canarias, prefiere morir a vivir en su tierra, uno no le pregunta si es por el clima, si es por el trabajo, si es por la religión, si es por la tribu, por lo que es. Simplemente es una persona que donde vivía no tenía esperanza y prefiere morir para tratar de construir la esperanza. Luego ese debate académico, francamente, no me parece lo más relevante. Yo sí creo que la Unión Europea, 27 países, el Consejo de Europa, 47 países, progresivamente tenemos que tener unos instrumentos más eficaces para hacer posible que en el ámbito de los movimientos humanos sea la ley y el orden quien impere y no, por el contrario, el crimen organizado. Eso es lo que pienso y por eso vengo aquí, porque creo que es muy importante que haya normas jurídicas y normas jurídicas ajustadas a la realidad del tiempo en el que estamos. A mí eso me parece fundamental. Y mientras tanto, voluntad política y acuerdo básico entre la gente de buena voluntad, que la hay en todos los partidos, en todas las religiones, orientaciones sexuales, filosóficas o políticas.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Mr. Della Vite in obra.
Muito obrigado. Eu queria, enfim, mostrar o meu completo acordo com o que o nosso colega da mesa acaba de dizer, assim como o senhor falou ali, e focando bem a questão pedagógica que todos nós temos de ter nos nossos respectivos países, para explicar a razão de ser desses movimentos. Efetivamente, foi aqui dito, até 2050, mais de 70 milhões de imigrantes. Isso são factos. E como se diz, contra factos não há argumentos. Um amigo no Senegal diz-me bem que só as aves morrem e nascem no mesmo sítio. Por isso, por mais que montemos sistemas de controle, vai ser impossível controlar eficazmente o movimento das populações. A história da humanidade sempre se fez na base de grandes migrações. Nós, em Portugal, sabemos muito bem como é que a nossa história, o nosso país, se constituiu. Quanto aos partidos de extrema-direita, eles veem, efetivamente, a migração uma ameaça, em vez de verem um desafio. Porque de um desafio se trata. Trata-se, talvez, de importar para a nossa Europa envelhecida uma capacidade de questionamento que povos mais jovens, mais dinâmicos, poderão trazer entre nós. Porque se formos apenas instaurar entre nós uma imigração seletiva, isto quer dizer, selecionarmos os quadros que nos interessam, nós estaremos a dar um péssimo sinal para a África e estaremos a empobrecê-la ainda muito mais. Não nos esqueçamos que todas as pessoas que chegam até nós estão em situação de particular stress pós-traumático. Não vos quero aqui, enfim, falar do síndrome de Ulisses e de outras situações psiquiátricas ou psicóticas que esses doentes muitas vezes apresentam, mas o facto é que ninguém sai do seu país se não houver uma razão imperiosa que os obriga a sair. Ninguém sai de livre vontade. E nós vamos ter que interiorizar isso uma vez por todas e tentarmos, a partir daí, então, criarmos as condições nos seus países de origem e nos nossos países para que esse fenómeno se faça com humanismo e com respeito pelos direitos humanos. Eu acho que isso é que é fundamental. A tal sensibilidade que eu falava há pouco vai nesse sentido. Muito obrigado.
Thank you very much. Mr. Falzon?
Yes, I'll try to answer a couple of questions that were raised. There was a question about interception. Clearly, when interception results in the saving of lives and, where necessary, in access to an asylum procedure, I don't think there are any human rights concerns with the practices. Interception becomes a human rights concern when it does not lead to any of these things. For example, when interception leads to pushback to a country where there's no asylum procedure, where interception results in not rescuing individuals under the belief that they can continue their journey by the provision of food and life jackets. So there are a number of situations where interception does not necessarily lead to saving of lives. I understand that obviously here we are not here to name and shame or point fingers, but I think it's very clear to everyone that last year's policy, the Italian policy of pushing back boats that were intercepted and pushed back to Libya, is clearly a policy that raises several human rights questions across the board, not only with reference to refugees. And this is, I want to clarify that we're not only speaking about refugees, but if we are speaking about pushbacks to a territory where not even protection under the European Convention on Human Rights may be guaranteed, in the sense of Italy or any other pushing back country being responsible for human rights violations in the territory they are sending persons to, then obviously these considerations apply not only to refugees, but obviously to the wider group of migrants traveling on the boats. So interception is good or bad, in inverted commas, depending on obviously what it leads to. Another question raised was whether the European Asylum Support Office and other measures might improve the human rights standards. From the way the EASO document has been drafted, it looks like it's going to be primarily a consultative body. It's not going to have monitoring powers, it's not going to have an enforcement role. This is not to say that I think it is totally useless. I think as far as it might assist governments in at least being more aware of their obligations and trying to assist governments in implementing their obligations, then obviously it could have a very strong role to play. But obviously we just have to wait and see what kind of momentum it will be given. You also mentioned if current migration policies and measures are good or not. The way I see it is, in as far as migration policies prevent loss of life by giving persons an opportunity to access EU territory legally, then it obviously has a beneficial effect. Now, obviously, depending on the details of such policy, then one would have to see if there are issues of brain drain, etc. But in so far as it is linked to preventing people from taking irregular means, and therefore the most dangerous means, then I think from that perspective, then yes, they could be beneficial. In terms of the issue raised at the beginning, because I used the terms economic refugee and environmental refugee, just to clarify, the term does not necessarily mean I'm attaching an illegal value to the term. However, it is undeniable that because of environmental degradation, a number of situations might arise which might make a person eligible for refugee status under existing criteria. As, for example, we all know the 1951 Convention does not cater for gender discrimination as one of the criteria, but through adaptation, through interpretation, it has been read into the Convention. Similarly, if a new situation arises, as, for example, environmental degradation, where persons could potentially have a refugee claim on the basis of ethnic conflict because of a struggle for water, for example, linked to environmental issues, then yes, I think we could conceive of the term environmental refugee. That's it for my point. Oh,
thank you very much. Again, two people who already talked, again asked for the floor, but are there also other people who didn't have the opportunity yet who want to add to the discussion? Yes? You have the floor, and then I'll come back to the others.
Sim, eu gostava de basicamente fazer um comentário. É óbvio que os países como Itália, Espanha, Malta são países que têm mais este problema e que vivem mais este problema. Portanto, é natural que tenham uma posição aparentemente mais radical. Em todo o caso, o que está em causa são sempre a forma, independentemente das regras de entrada ou de saída, a forma como as pessoas nestas circunstâncias são tratadas. Independentemente juridicamente ou não, o termo refugiado económico poder ser usado ou o termo refugiado climático, não é esse sentido jurídico que está em causa, é o sentido da realidade. E, como dizia também o Dr. Fernando de Nobre há pouco, há um direito humano que é básico, que é também o direito a ter, como dizia um professor meu, o professor Adriano Moreira, que muito admiro, é o direito a ter condições para sobreviver. E se calhar é esse direito humano que falta nos países de origem e que leva as pessoas a saírem. Agora, o que está em causa não é a política dos Estados de regular a entrada e de gerir a imigração. O que está em causa é que as pessoas que procuram os Estados sejam, com respeito pelos direitos humanos, integradas ou afastadas. É isso que está em causa.
Thank you very much. You didn't tell us your name and the organization.
Sim. Meu nome é Luísa Maia Gonçalves e pertenço à Direção Central de Investigação de Serviços Estrangeiros e Fronteiras.
Okay. Mr. Willer.
Almost feel I have to apologize for taking the floor a second time. But the gentleman who was calling non-right-wing politicians to take back the discussion, I'm sorry, absolutely unacceptable, because we are the lawmakers, and what all you are since the morning defending and on which we have voted, it is us and nobody else who have done it, with the help of a lot of basic people. And secondly, maybe you should also say this, when in my country, for example, there is now a move for a new regularization of 100,000 people who are there since more than 8 years and who never got the final decision, you know when it is in the international press who is calling us day and night to tell us, for God's sake, don't do that? It is the ministers of the interior of Spain and Italy and all these other countries who tell us, for God's sake, if you are going to do it, we will have to do it again. Why not we discuss this? And I will not leave this item to the extreme right or the extreme left. I want this to be a debate in the middle of all democratic parties. But for God's sake, don't say we have to take this item back. We live with it day and night and proud to have the legislation that we have.
Thank you. I think Malta felt challenged. Okay, you have the floor.
First of all, I have to apologize, but we are a country that is in dealing with these issues. And I think in dealing with these issues, we have gained an insight and experience. And let us drop this demonization, this axis of evil countries and bad countries. Let us stick to facts. I completely agree with my Portuguese colleague. Nobody is saying that because we designate someone as a refugee, that means we're going to give him right, and if we say someone is an economic migrant, that person doesn't have a right. Let us calm down. If you look at Malta, the country with the highest per capita in the world asylum applications. Malta, one of the countries with the highest rate of acceptance, 50%. It is not just because Malta is particularly benevolent, it's also because the people that we receive come from a big... I'm not saying this to pat Malta on the back. The reality is that a big number of the applicants we receive come from genuine countries. But I'm being practical here. Please, there is a distinction. We cannot treat someone coming from
to our shores in search of a better economic life in the same manner as a vulnerable woman who's coming from a situation where she has seen her family killed in front of her eyes. We have to give priority. That's the one thing. Now, the issue of monitoring, in response to what Mr. Falzon said, yes, the issue of monitoring is of extreme importance, but I believe in the new Lisbon Treaty there is a new evaluation mechanism. Up to this point, it does not cover the issues of asylum. It is strictly covering the area of judicial cooperation. But the intention is very clear. And in a council of ministers, in a council decision of last December, people referred to this evaluation, and they specifically referred to the Council of Europe monitoring mechanisms that could come into play. So that is why we have to be careful. One last point. I feel a lot of sympathy for what my Belgian colleague is saying. We need to wake up. We have a situation in Europe where progressively voters are telling us something very scary. And I am, on a personal level, I am very concerned. Luckily it has not happened in my country up to now. Up to now. The debate has steered from the racist to the less racist to the more considerate, but at the end of the day, fortunately, people have not elected extreme right deputies to our parliament, and that is where we will have a problem. So I think we need to sit down and listen to what our people are saying. Not to accept, but let us not suppress feelings.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lindblad, and then
over. Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I don't want to take more room here than what is really wanted, but explicitly, Madam Chair, you asked me to have more discussion by the present parliamentarians, and therefore I take the floor again. Of course, there are differences between those that try to find a new future and those who really have reasons for asylum. However, we need both. For demographic reasons, Europe needs a large migration, even though now, during the present crisis, it may not look that way in all countries. But in the long run, we really have to have a migration of 20, 25 million people into Europe, because in some of our countries, we have a birth rate that does not reproduce. If the birth rate in Italy, for example, continues, the population in three generations will be cut into one-fourth of what it is today. And, well, I don't think that's acceptable. An Italian colleague said at another conference at the OSCE that we can have government decisions and promote family planning. Well, they have tried to do that, and I don't think they have a fast track in Italy. It takes 9 months to make a child if you go and make them tonight, and then it's 20 years before they can start work. So there are no fast tracks, so we need a lot of migration. And regardless of that, we have a responsibility as politicians to take the debate, as Mr. Willis says, against the extreme right. We must do it. That may be, I take it all the time, and maybe the explanation why I'm not so high up on the ballot for the next election. But it is our responsibility, it's everyone's responsibility to take this discussion and tell our voters, as well as our colleagues in other countries, that one, we need more migration. Two, we have to take responsibility for those in need. And that should be our focus.
Thank you very much. And I think you're not the last one. Then you're the last one, and then I'll come back to the panelists.
Merci, Madame la Présidente. Michel Villan, du Comité européen sur l'immigration. Je voudrais quand même élargir un tout petit peu le débat par rapport à ce qui a été présenté jusque maintenant. Je partage effectivement les données démographiques qui ont été présentées par le sénateur espagnol. Il y a, en termes de perspective, surtout pour l'Europe, pour bon nombre de pays européens, un déficit démographique, et donc pour maintenir un niveau de vie, il faudra nécessairement que l'immigration continue. Au niveau du Comité européen sur l'immigration, ce que nous essayons de promouvoir, c'est que la migration puisse être utile aux pays d'accueil et aux pays d'origine. Tant qu'on ne parvient pas à développer ces politiques qui vont permettre aux uns et aux autres d'avoir un plus par rapport à ce qu'ils ont aujourd'hui, eh bien là, on restera toujours avec des déséquilibres, parce que, comme on l'a dit justement, les personnes qui vivent dans la misère, qui vivent dans l'oppression, qui vivent dans l'insécurité, d'une manière ou d'une autre, elles essaieront toujours de partir pour un avenir meilleur. Et donc, moi, ce que j'aimerais bien, c'est que ça soit au niveau du Conseil de l'Europe, mais que ça soit surtout au niveau de l'Union européenne, c'est qu'il y ait davantage de politiques qui permettent. Nous avons sorti au niveau du Comité européen sur la migration une recommandation sur le co-développement. Comment faire en sorte que, y compris des migrants, avec les pouvoirs publics des pays d'accueil, puissent se mettre quelque part en accord ou en développant des projets dans les pays du Sud ou dans les pays de l'Est. Parce que tant qu'il n'y a pas ce genre d'accord entre pays d'origine, pays de transit ou pays d'origine, il y aura toujours des flux migratoires qui viendront. Et donc, alors je ne dis pas que tout ça va résoudre, mais si on donne un peu d'espoir par rapport aux pays d'origine, là je crois qu'il y a une perspective et donc j'aimerais avoir l'opinion des panélistes.
Thank you. And now the last participant.
Thank you very much. Just to take up what Paul Diller said and some of the speakers right now, I would fully agree that the Council of Europe could be, and it is, a good place to debate such questions very openly. This is the first point. The second one is that if you regard immigration policies in Europe, you cannot just discuss, on one hand, humanitarian rights, human rights, humanitarian concerns, and forget the other side. We are like that. We are asking, what is the migration going to bring us? So, to open a door is one way of illusion. Again, to close completely the door is another illusion. Now, the last point is the demographic changes. We all know that, yes, we need migration, but also we know that those people who migrate and produce the children in our societies in Europe, this effect prevails in the first generation, but not anymore in the third one, not anymore in the fourth one. They don't produce the children. So one should be very, very cautious with the demographic changes and migration. We need much more than that. But nevertheless, this issue should be discussed. And just to tell you one last sentence to this point, when Commissioner Vitorino, who comes from this country and a very high-profile politician, took over the European File on Justice and Home Affairs in 1999, we consulted a lot, and the first question was, well, we could use at that time the report of the UNDP on population growth, and at the end it proved to be a no-go in our population and our voters. It didn't bring us further in the discussion. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. And now I want to give the floor for 1 minute to end up from the panelists.
Gracias, señora presidenta. Le pido disculpas a usted porque antes no respondía a su pregunta. Fue un olvido por mi parte y le ruego que me disculpe. Si comparamos la política europea actual con el pasado, se ha avanzado muchísimo. Si lo comparamos con lo que deberíamos tener y necesitamos tener, todavía es profundamente insuficiente. Lo de Frontex, por mucho que lo cuidemos y lo potenciemos y le pongamos muchos recursos, sigue siendo insuficiente, primero. Segundo, este es un fenómeno que nos va a acompañar siempre. Tiene aspectos necesarios y positivos, pero si no se le mete razón y derecho, predominará el crimen organizado, porque después de la droga y las armas es el mejor negocio que tienen. Y el mercado siempre ha sido muy listo. En la actualidad le sigue ganando a la política, al Estado y al derecho. Tercero, en España hay 1 millón de personas, posiblemente algunas votarían extrema derecha, que están cobrando su pensión porque hay emigrantes que han cotizado a la Seguridad Social. Si no, no estarían cobrando su pensión. Cuarto, los que están emigrando son los más jóvenes, los más fuertes y los más cualificados. Ciertamente, esto seguirá así mientras no cambiemos la relación entre los países enriquecidos y los países empobrecidos.
Eso es lo que pienso de fondo. Mientras tanto, buena voluntad, derecho, política y sentido común. Siempre, por muy floja y mala que sea, siempre será mejor la política, el Estado y el derecho, siempre al crimen organizado, siempre.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lapiterro, Nobra.
Só minuto. Efetivamente, se nos próximos 40 anos precisarmos de mais de 70 milhões de imigrantes, isso é quase na média de 2 milhões por ano. Os números representam talvez 30 a 40% do que está...
Sorry, I don't have translation. I don't know if my problem... Yes, now yes. Thank you very much.
Pronto, o senhor estava a dizer, se até 2050 precisarmos de mais de 70 milhões de imigrantes, isso quer dizer quase uma média de 2 milhões por ano. Quer dizer 20 a 40 vezes o que está a acontecer atualmente na União Europeia. Por isso, é urgente que as políticas sejam preparadas, que o sistema esteja preparado, porque senão o que se pode pôr em causa rapidamente na Europa, repito, são as nossas próprias democracias. Os partidos racistas, xenófobos e populistas vão pegar nessa matéria para encontrarem trunfos eleitoralistas fáceis. Por isso, aos políticos responsáveis da Europa, importa desde já tomar as medidas preventivas que se impõem. Repito, nós estamos numa situação de arma estrangulada. Importa reagir e reagir rapidamente. Não podemos esperar mais 10 anos para medidas que permitam a integração em massa de tanta gente. Muito obrigado.
Thank you. Mr. Falzon?
Yes, okay. The main points I want to make in conclusion linked to interception is essentially that I think an effort we need to make is to avoid a situation where this summer or next summer we have the same situation as in previous years. People waiting on boats until governments decide and discuss who is going to rescue them and disembark. Situations where you have persons who are rescued and then sent to an unsafe third country. Situations where persons are rescued but allowed to continue the journey and if they are lucky they actually make it to a safe journey. And I think what we do really need, especially in the maritime section from a legal and even operational perspective, is the need to find a forum within which to discuss the technical issues related to maritime law, rescue at sea and the related issues. A forum that would bring together the Council of Europe, UNHCR, IOM, Frontex and every other agency involved in the issue. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much. We don't have to summarize in this workshop. We will do it later, all together with the persons who joined workshop B, so that's not where we have to do right now. Then I want to finish by thanking you all for the participation and your contribution in this workshop. And I hope, of course, to see you back at 5 o'clock, because now we are going for a cup of coffee. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for being here at this hour and with this warmth. But we still have a task, and that is to report back from the workshops A and B. I had the privilege to be the chair of the work group A, and John Greenway was the chair of workshop B. I leave my summarize to Neil Folson. He was the rapporteur of workshop E, and then the floor is to John.
So, good afternoon. Our workshop discussed interception at sea and related issues. And the debates went on to a more general note and we discussed migration from a much broader perspective. However, a number of very interesting points came out and the debate itself was very interesting because we had a number of participants challenging each other and asking each other various questions. I think the main consensus reached in our discussion, our workshop, was that we all have a very good understanding of the major problems relating to migration and asylum issues. The major situation is known by most actors, most parties, especially parties present. the causes for forced flights are known by governments, organizations, and individuals. And the question we kept asking ourselves was, how come we don't act on these problems? Knowing the options available to all of us, how come there's no concerted action to deal with the situation? And the debate tries to come up with a number of answers on why there isn't this kind of action at the moment. One of the reasons given was, in fact, a reflection of the general tone of our debate, which somehow shifted from a legal perspective to a more political and social tone. So one of the political answers given to the question of why isn't there enough action was that, from a political perspective, there's a need to understand a lot of the internal debate within a number of governments. The very strong xenophobic and right-wing tones, the pressure internally from voters, and even, again, from a political perspective, that some governments feel overburdened by the number of arrivals reaching their shores. This sentiment was voiced by the Mediterranean countries, primarily Greece, Italy, Malta, and Spain, highlighting the fact that whilst they understand and appreciate the need to uphold human rights, there are a lot of internal pressures, amongst which, as I mentioned, the xenophobic tendencies within the country, and also the external pressure from the arrivals reaching their shores, and therefore the difficulty to act in a more appropriate manner, possibly. In answer to this, the debate raised the issue of the desperate need there is to continue to educate the public and to educate the voters on the plight of refugees, causes for migration, to try to create a more aware public understanding and therefore affect political debate in a much more balanced tone. A question that was aired was, where are the human rights voices within public debate? So often we hear the negative tones, the xenophobic and the racist comments, but there isn't enough of a balance in public debate, and therefore the need to educate, the need to balance out the debate. Another answer to the question of why don't we act was a legal kind of answer, and we examined whether or not the current legal instruments relating to interception at sea and international maritime law are sufficient to deal with the present scenario we are facing today. The debate wasn't clear as to whether the instruments are sufficient or not. The general consensus, however, was that we do have a package of laws at the moment. International maritime law does have extensive provisions on interception at sea. We also have a large bundle of human rights legislation, regional and international, and there is the constant need to reinterpret these laws to adapt the laws to current situations, particularly in the case of interception at sea. There was a lot of practical insight into the situation out at sea, but also the situation in countries of origin, especially by one of the panelists. And again, consensus was on the need to ensure adequate standard of living, adequate living conditions in countries of origin, to deal with the problems of refugee plight at its source. So therefore, there was the understanding that the development aid and the development assistance, rural development, would be necessary to tackle the problem at its roots, and in an attempt to prevent flows of migrants attempting the dangerous journey across the Mediterranean and across various dangerous borders. There was also another tone where we spoke about the need European governments have for an influx of migrants given the demographic deficit at the moment. And there were some questions raised about the advantages or disadvantages of current contemporary EU efforts to try to deal with migration, as for example the Blue Card, the European Asylum Support Office, as to whether they are helping the situation or otherwise. There was a very, very interesting and very heated debate on whether it is preferable or not to classify persons in terms of refugees, non-refugees, this kind of person, that kind of person, and what kind of rights attach to what kind of status. One side of debates seemed to insist more on the strict need to identify persons in need of protection as one group and not to mix up one group with another. I think, as a conclusion, what we can say is, and maybe I can repeat what was said earlier this morning, is that we need to acknowledge the fact that the arrivals being faced, particularly in the Mediterranean region, are of a mixed and composed nature. And we do need to acknowledge that different persons do have different needs, and depending on the situation, they should have access to various levels of rights. However, on the basis that human rights are always universal, and everyone, no matter their status, legal status, nationality, etc., should have anyway access to at least the international human rights standards that we all are aware of. The last conclusion we reached and it was a general conclusion, is that there is a need for concerted action to deal with the situation. And this goes back to the original question of why is there not enough action. We did agree that there's a need for more solidarity, not only in the sense of solidarity with governments who are facing maybe a larger burden than others, but solidarity amongst governments to help deal with the situation, solidarity with migrants arriving at the shores, governments acting together to try to understand the phenomenon and deal with it in an appropriate manner, and also with specific reference to interception at sea and the human rights concerns raised by interception, the need to have a kind of interagency forum where all the parties relevant and related to interception could meet together to discuss the legal challenges and the operational solutions. If I'm leaving anything out from the workshop, I invite the panelists to raise any other issues. Thanks.
But I think first we give the floor to workshop B, and then maybe later on there are some persons again who want to respond, maybe on A or on B. John? Okay.
Well then, without further ado, let me hand over immediately to our rapporteur, Nuala Moll, to give you the report back from workshop B on detention.
Thank you very much. We first of all looked at both the material conditions in which immigration detainees are held, and then we looked at the closely connected phenomenon of the lack of legal regimes and lack of legal safeguards in which they are held. So that combination of poor conditions and poor legal regimes conspires to give the immigration detainee far fewer rights than somebody who is held in detention in the criminal justice system. We emphasize that foreigners who are detained under aliens legislation should not be treated as criminals, and that they should have, at the very least, conditions and legal safeguards equivalent to people who are detained within the criminal justice station, criminal justice system. However, recognizing that they themselves have not committed any criminal offence, nor are suspected of having done so, that they should be accommodated in conditions which reflect their legal status. We were concerned by the lack of fundamental legal safeguards for irregular migrants, and emphasised again in looking at conditions and regimes of detention that detention should be a measure of last resort. We went through some very specific issues, like being able to consult doctors, lawyers, consular officials if wanted. Particularly, we looked at the importance of having professionally trained staff, and that unnecessarily humiliating treatment, like the handcuffing of detainees who are already in a secure environment, should be discontinued. But most importantly, that everyone who is held in detention deprived of his liberty in an immigration context has the same rights of access to a lawyer and the same right to be told the precise reasons for which he or she is being detained in a language which is understood. We looked also at some of the very serious absences of material conditions, lack of activities, lack of exercise, lack of access to outdoors, and the cavalier way in which the officials in some of these detention centres openly carry instruments of force in situations which are profoundly disturbing to people who may already be suffering from a great deal of stress and psychological anxiety because of the treatment to which they were exposed before they left their countries of origin. And we particularly attended to the detrimental impact of on the physical and psychological state of people who are held in detention for a very long time without any knowledge about when the process would come to an end or what the outcome would be. Again, this contrasts very much with people who are held in criminal detention. we emphasized again and again that the importance of exploring alternatives to detention, and that was a point which was also made in Mrs. Mendoza's report. We didn't go through every part of Mrs. Mendoza's report, but we particularly supported the 10 guiding principles which she had proposed and the 15 rules which she had proposed to the Committee of Ministers, including detention as a measure of last resort. Two of the contributors recommended that it was important that human rights should be respected even in alternatives to detention, that it wasn't enough simply to release people from detention. We agreed at the end of our session that we should press for a number of measures. One was that the Committee of Ministers of the Council of Europe should be pressed for an urgent response to the recommendation, which is in paragraph 5 of recommendation 1900 of 2010, about setting up an expert body and a consultative body to look at this. Secondly, that standards which are at an unacceptable level and fall below those of the European prison rules should not be allowed to apply to immigration detainees. In other words, that immigration detainees should have standards at least equal to those which apply to people in the criminal justice system. We discussed the need for having a binding legal instrument that might be needed to become an enforceable standard to reinforce the patchwork provision that is currently provided by the European Court of Human Rights when it looks at complaints that are brought by immigrant detainees under Article 3, Article 5 and Article 13 of the European Convention. And then we particularly wanted to make sure that it was made very clear to all member states of the Council of Europe, all 47 member states, that detention of migrants in violation of Article 3 cannot continue. UNHCR made the very valid point that the EU Returns Directive, which puts an absolute limit on the amount of time for which illegal migrants can be held in detention before being expelled, does not apply to an asylum seeker whose claim has not yet been determined, and that that's an unfortunate contrast. And in particular, we wanted to recommend that all those who are hired by states to maintain immigration detention centres must be sufficiently well trained to enable them to carry out their tasks to a high professional standard. We thought it was particularly important to ensure that restrictions on freedom of movement and detention were imposed in accordance with the law, and that one of the big problems that exists is that very often lawyers and NGOs cannot get access to people in detention centres, particularly in some particular countries of Southeast Europe, and it therefore means that those people are effectively deprived of such remedies that exist, and that that must come to an end very soon. We could have gone on for another 2 hours, but we didn't.
Well, thank you very much. I just want to add a couple of points to that. The first is that although we didn't discuss it in a great deal detail, in fact we hardly mentioned it at all, throughout the day I've had a very clear feeling from what people have said to me in private conversations that the detention of children is simply unacceptable. And I would be very glad if at this moment anybody who thinks that the detention of children is acceptable, if they would make their case. Otherwise, we're going to assume by acquiescence that the view of the conference is that children should not be detained. Are you happy with that, Madeleine? You're content? Good. Thank you very much. I mean, I made that point in my opening speech this morning. Interestingly, the new coalition government, Conservative Liberal Democrat government in the UK, is to pass a law to make it illegal. So the passage of the legislation will prove very interesting. The second point I want to make is that as the afternoon discussion wore on, it became more and more obvious to me that the Migration Committee of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe is in a very good position to make the running on the issues that Nuala has just outlined and those conclusions. We have the Mendonça report, which was adopted by the Assembly in January. It's currently with the Committee of Ministers. The Committee of Ministers has 2 years in which to respond. They've not responded yet. But again, if I could take your mood, what I've said to our committee secretariat is that there will be some communique or some concluding document arising from this conference, and that it's my intention that as the chairperson of the Migration PACE committee, that I should write to the chair of the Committee of Ministers, not only reminding him and them of the conclusions in the Mendonça report, which, if I could just take your patience for 1 second more, the critical recommendation, this paragraph 5 that Nuala mentioned, the Assembly recommended that the Committee of Ministers instructed the relevant expert committee, we have several within the Council of Europe, to prepare for them European rules on minimum standards of conditions of detention of irregular migrants and asylum seekers, the aim of which would be to provide in the context of immigration detention a parallel framework to the European prison rules, which apply only to prisons for criminals and not to detention centres for irregular migrants and asylum seekers. So we've already made this recommendation. And the conclusion that we just had of this two-hour discussion is that this is the very least that we should have. And Nuala referred to in the resolution of the document, it also talks about the 10 guiding principles which should apply before detention takes place, and the 15 rules which should apply if detention does take place. So is it agreed that we should press this? Because I think that this is the way, I think, by which we can try and form some common standard. Whether it amounts to a binding legal instrument, which we discussed, is difficult to judge. But, you know, we're going to open it up for debate in a moment. But I sense that the problem is that a number of countries have been on the wrong side of decisions in the European Court of Human Rights in respect of breaches of Article 3, and yet it still goes on. So, given that we've always maintained that the starting point for resolving any human rights problem within the Council of Europe member states is to actually get people to live up to and enforce what it is they signed up to, then this, I think, should be the way we should proceed. So, again, does anybody violently disagree? So now, we can open up the floor, and I don't know how we went. Should we just have one common debate and see how it goes?
I think so.
Okay. So our colleague from Malta and my good friend from Spain. So you have the floor, sir.
Keep it short.
And can we have brief comments? We don't want long speeches because it's nearly 20 minutes time. We've finished.
I would like to remind the chairman of the PACE committee that the Committee of Ministers has recently replied to Recommendation 1850. Recently, the Committee of Ministers replied to Recommendation 1850-2008. Within this recommendation, the Parliamentary Assembly recommended that the Committee of Ministers adopts guidelines for minimum standards to be applied to the detention of irregular migrants. That is essentially a very similar recommendation. And actually the Committee of Ministers has only very recently replied to this. So my feeling is that the Committee of Ministers is going to give you the same reply, which in effect is the Committee of Ministers acknowledges that there is an EU directive, 2003, which deals precisely with minimum standards of receptions. And this, the EU acknowledges that this directive is not enough.
that there are huge issues when it comes to detention centers. And the EU is recasting this directive. So the view of the Committee of Ministers, the view of the Committee of Ministers is that we should not duplicate, the work that is being done in the EU at this particular stage. And I have a question. Because the issue of duplication is becoming very, very, very real. Within the Committee of Ministers, there's a very strong feeling, and it's not going to go away. We need to talk about this. That there is a lot of duplication between the work of the Council of Europe and the European Union. What kind of synergies are we looking at? And this is a question.
Let me take that. I mean, I made the point this morning that the Council of Europe is 47 countries, 20 of them are not members of the European Union, and, you know, we all understand and accept that, and part of the problem of migration management is the fact that a lot of migrants are coming through non-EU countries into EU countries, and that is something that we constantly discuss. I mean, the issue of the synergy of the EU and the Council of Europe in respect to the migration issue is a problem. Had I spoken for longer this morning than the time I was allowed, I would have raised this point, that we in the Council of Europe Assembly are absolutely adamant that issues in relation to human rights are our prerogative. We cannot stop the fact that the EU has its own migration management ideas and concepts and policies. I mean, I see the gentleman shaking his head, but, you know, it is a fact of life. But whether you're talking about EU countries or non-EU countries, to lock people up in conditions which don't even meet minimum prison standards is simply not acceptable. That is what we're really trying to say. That is the argument that we put. And, you know, we if need be, we could, look, we have a much better dialogue now between the Committee of Ministers and the Council of Europe Assembly. Believe me, we do have a much better dialogue. I mean, I'm trying to think who was in Macedonia. Paul Willer, you were in Macedonia with me last week for the Bureau and Standing Committee, and, you know, we are very encouraged by, and Paul is reacting, so we will deal with that. Okay.
Yes. Paul. Mr. Diaz.
Grazie, signor Presidente. Apoyo la propia iniciativa que usted ha tenido, la de antes en la que no hablé, y esta también en la que hablo. Porque cualquier iniciativa que tenga usted, como su antecesora, Corinne Juncker, para promocionar derechos humanos y para reducir y limitar esto que se llama detención, yo la apoyaré. Incluso me preocupa que ya hayamos aceptado la palabra detención, porque una persona que comete un crimen y tiene dinero para conseguir la libertad provisional, está en libertad. Esta persona no ha cometido ningún crimen, tan solo no tienen papeles administrativos, se les detiene e incluso hay países europeos que pueden estar hasta 18 meses en una prisión, sin haber cometido ningún crimen. Entonces, el planteamiento de reducir, limitar, condicionar, siempre que sea a la baja, no para extender los 18 meses, sino para reducir a la baja, y en la medida de lo posible que sean limitaciones administrativas a su libertad de circulación o a su libertad para deambular. Pero francamente, hasta sería bueno que reconsiderásemos el uso de esa expresión, porque ya está consolidadísima y aceptadísima como normal que alguien, por no tener papeles, aunque no haya cometido ningún solo crimen, se le meta en una cárcel hasta 18 meses. Yo creo que sería bueno no aceptar la inocencia de las palabras, porque francamente nunca son inocentes, tampoco ahora. En cualquier caso, esa o cualquier otra iniciativa que pretenda reducir, la voy a apoyar, por supuesto, señor Presidente. Y gracias por dejarme hablar.
I'm going to ask our rapporteur, Noala Mole, to respond to you, because it isn't quite what we think it is.
Well, there are a number of issues here, one of which is that some irregular migrants and some asylum seekers may, in certain circumstances, have committed either criminal or administrative offences in the situation in which they find themselves. The point is they are not being prosecuted for the commission of those offences. Under the Refugee Convention, they can't be penalised from having reached in order to claim asylum. But some irregular migrants are being placed in detention on the basis that they have done something which constitutes an administrative or criminal offence, but they're not being prosecuted for it. And the rule of law requires that if you're being deprived of your liberty because you're suspected of having committed a criminal or administrative offence, there has to be a prosecution for it, and that's not happening. People are just being placed in detention. The second point is the point about in relation to the Reception Conditions Directive, which is to say that the Reception Conditions Directive is there and requires states to work in a way which should reduce the incidence of detention ignores the fact that some states fail to transpose the Reception Conditions Directive, and even those states which have now properly transposed the Reception Conditions Directive fail to implement it. But I do want to come back, because we talked about this in our session this afternoon, to this 18 months under the Returns Directive. Firstly, the 18 months of maximum detention does not apply to asylum seekers. It only applies to people who have finally been refused, determined that they are illegal migrants, and are being held with a view to being returned. The Returns Directive doesn't apply to people unless they're being returned, unless they've come to the end of a process and they're being returned. And secondly, as we discussed this afternoon, the Returns Directive specifies that people can be held for a maximum of 6 months. And only in exceptional conditions can that 6 months be extended to 12 months. And only in the most exceptional conditions can that 12 months be extended to 18 months. But what we are seeing is the routine use of the 18 months absolute maximum in cases which would not be justifiable because of the exceptional conditions that were foreseen in the Returns Directive for prolonging detention beyond 6 months. And the most important thing, of course, is and contained both in the Returns Directive and in the jurisprudence of the European Court of Human Rights, is that if you cannot remove somebody, and there have been cases, two or three more cases only in the last month out of Strasbourg, if you cannot remove somebody, you can no longer hold them in detention with a view to removal. Because if you can't remove them, they cease to be being held with a view to removal. There's got to be a reasonable relationship between the purpose of the detention, which is to effect their removal, and the realistic probability of removing them. And people who have no documentation and people who have no means of being sent back cannot be held in detention for 6, 12 or 18 months because the legal justification for the detention has gone.
Thank you very much. Do I see anyone else wanting to take the floor? Mr. Falzon.
I'd like to maybe bring back to some issues raised in our workshop. And I'd like to maybe copy a method you've just used at throwing out the statement and seeing that there's consensus or otherwise. I just wanted to ask and maybe see if there's any kind of discussion on the issue, how comfortable people are with Council of Europe governments pushing back migrants, including asylum seekers, either from their territorial waters or from the high seas, to a territory, to a country where these persons would not have access to asylum procedure, and where there are no guarantees for their human rights protection.
It's a double negative.
Are there things that people want to add? Is there something we didn't see or take in?
Someone.
Yeah. Mr. Lindlof.
I just comment Mr. Fawson's question, because it was a question, wasn't it? It is absolutely not acceptable to push people back like that. And for the other issue with detention, it's a European Guantanamo situation, and we should call it that.
Mr. Lindblad, I think you have to move a little bit towards the microphone.
Usually I don't even need a microphone, but okay. According to Mr. Fawson's comment, I would say it's not acceptable at all to push people back. And I think most of the people in this room would agree to that, otherwise I'd be a little bit surprised and scared. And when it comes to the detention, I would say it's similar to Guantanamo situation, where people are in limbo without any prosecution or any courts or anything, and we should call it exactly that.
I know this.
Thank you very much.
You all the time feel challenged. But I have one question. Are there people from operations of interception at sea who can add something to this? Because I know that reality is not always as nice as politicians and also human rights defenders likes to have it. So are there, I'm also worked at the immigration service in the Netherlands, and I know that you always have to face with the practical circumstances, and sometimes, again, they are not as nice as you hoped for. But is there somebody who can, I think there are some people from Portugal working in the, okay. If you'd floor.
Boa tarde, posso falar alguma coisa sobre o assunto operacional? Tipo a intervir na... Não intervi, mas tipo a intervir na, no nosso workshop, porque na realidade nós operacionalmente temos muitas dificuldades. Por exemplo, caso real, quando nós dizemos, e bem, que não devemos entregar a um país que tem problemas de segurança, devemos entregar um imigrante ilegal em segurança. Nós, por exemplo, temos o caso de Somália. Somália, eles fazem imigração ilegal até ao Iémen e quando voltam para baixo fazem pirataria. O que se passa na realidade é quando nós vamos a uma situação de imigrantes ilegais, com embarcações com 40, 50 pessoas a bordo, quando ficamos com eles no navio, não temos país a quem entregar, porque não podemos entregar à Somália, porque não é um país que nos dê segurança em termos de direitos humanos. E, portanto, quais são as hipóteses que nos sobram? Obviamente que numa situação em que esteja em causa search and rescue, nós temos que lá ir. Mas, noutras situações, nós não andamos à procura de imigrantes ilegais. O nosso core business é, essencialmente, a pirataria. E, portanto, em termos muito resumidos, nós temos diversos problemas, inclusive... Nós falámos um bocadinho no nosso workshop e foi muito discutido outra vez aqui o problema do artigo 98 e do artigo 110 da nossa Convenção de Montego Bay. Nós, no alto mar, só vamos em três situações, não é? Portanto, vamos numa situação em que não tem bandeira, de acordo com o artigo 110, nós podemos ir sempre a bordo, nas situações de acordo com a Convenção de Human Smuggling. E, portanto, de acordo com o protocolo de Human Smuggling, nós vamos nas situações em que o país de bandeira nos pede para nós irmos a bordo ou na situação em que nós pedimos ao país de bandeira e ele autoriza. Mas, e nós discutimos aqui um bocadinho no nosso workshop um problema de interpretação diferente por parte dos países. E um dos problemas de interpretação diferente é de uma convenção que não foi aqui chamada ainda, de convenção relativa à Search and Rescue. Porque Portugal, por exemplo, não tem qualquer dúvida de que se tiver iminente um afundamento por parte de uma embarcação com 40 imigrantes ilegais, de que temos que intervir. Outros países começam a pôr em causa, porque reparem que um imigrante ilegal, a primeira ação que ele toma é mandar-se água, por forma a poder ser recolhido e pedido asilo. E nós temos que recolher. E a partir do momento que os recolhemos, ficamos com jurisdição sobre aqueles elementos que vão pedir asilo e tem que haver uma decisão em Portugal, ao nível devido, se damos ou não damos asilo. Portanto, há aqui vários problemas, principalmente quando estamos longe no mar e nos aparecem situações de imigrantes ilegais. Porque quando estamos longe e não temos onde nos entregar, teremos que os trazer de alguma forma para cá, e eu pergunto
muito de avião ou fazemos os dias todos de navegação para os trazer. E, portanto, há aqui muitos problemas, obviamente, operacionais que se põem nesta situação. Obrigado.
Thank you very much, and I think it's very important to add all this to the discussions we had. Mr. Willer, you want the floor?
Yes, Madam Chair, because the question as raised by Mr. Faison is not making me happy as question, because it may have negative effects. It's a dangerous question, a political question also. Because if this morning somebody said, well, if you cannot come in a legal way, you have no other chance than to come in an illegal way. Also that I didn't like very much. Because if you come as an economic migrant, why should my country not have the right to take the time to say that this is a misunderstanding, because we don't take economic migrants until and unless that we take some for specific reasons, special jobs for special, that is another matter. But if you raise the question and if you answer it in the very generous way of Mr. Lindblad, I can tell you that the public opinion in my country, and not only the extreme right-wing parties, is going to abuse that question and especially that answer to go against a number of honest moral things. So, I did not say that my country is not wealthy enough to take asylum seekers. Yes, we do. But if you want to say we will definitely open and then treat, let them come and we will see and then we will pay. And obviously since they are there and that we are going to make sure that our judges are not going to come to a verdict within 7 years. After 7 years we are going to say that unfortunately now it has become not correct to send them back. If you want me to answer in such a way to your question, then the answer is no.
Mrs. Small, you want to respond?
Very short, please. I'm very pleased that you made that intervention, because I think there is a fundamental principle that in these discussions we frequently lose sight of. And that is, it is a key attribute of state sovereignty to admit or refuse to admit aliens to their territory. And we need to remind ourselves of that. On the other hand, states are obliged to meet their obligations in international law to those individuals who come and seek international protection somewhere within their jurisdiction. And there are many people intercepted at sea, arriving by land, who do not qualify for international protection. And what the measures that are being adopted at European level are supposed to do is to ensure that those people, if possible, can be assisted to make a voluntary return if they have no right to be in the European country to which they have come, and if they have to have a forced return, that such forced returns are carried out with dignity and humanity. But nobody is suggesting that everyone has the right to come. The unfortunate thing is that a boat with 45 people on it may have 5 people who are genuinely in need of international protection, and 40 people who have no claim to be there, and therefore the state's necessity is to sort the sheep from the goats and to do so in a manner which accords with the rule of law and with international protection. And I don't underestimate the difficulties that our colleague here has with the purposes of search and rescue operations, with SOLAS, with SARS, with the difference between the high seas, I mean, all the complications of search and rescue operations. But in the end, once the state, once people come within the jurisdiction of a state, whether it's in a Frontex operation or on the high seas, then that state has to deal with them in accordance with its international obligations. But I do not envy you your task.
Just to remind colleagues that one of the parallel workshop sessions in the second half of tomorrow morning is on the subject of expulsion and forced returns. And for the benefit of people who are not members of the Council of Europe Assembly Migration Committee, We have always made absolutely clear that failed asylum seekers should be returned. Because if you think about it, if you do not return failed asylum seekers, where that's possible, then the whole integrity of the asylum process is undermined. And in all debates, I think what comes across is that genuine asylum seekers, as Mr. Wooler just said, are welcome in all our countries. But the fact is that there is a handful mixed up with a lot of economic migrants, and managing that's very, very difficult. I think that's what I wanted to say. Yes, I'll give the floor back to Corinne. Thank you.
Thank you. I think, Neil, you wanted to finalise?
Maybe just as a final comment in response to your comment, and maybe just taking off from what Noel answered, it's just to say that you're right in saying that you do receive economic migrants, but the only way you would know if an individual is an economic migrant is by identifying the individual, processing the individual's claims, and then you can say that the person is an economic migrant, and if necessary, return the person. But until you allow the person into the territory, and if the person requests it, seeks asylum, then you can confirm which way the individual is to be processed.
Okay. Thank you very much. Can you be short? Is that possible? That's a challenge, of course, but then I'll give you the floor.
Thank you, Chair, for allowing me the floor. Hopefully I'm not abusing the floor as rapporteur, but I just wanted to ask a question with regard, because I wasn't in there, I couldn't be in the detention session, with regard to alternatives to detention. Because when you look at the return directive, for example, it refers to detaining people who may abscond or not cooperate with the authorities, and it's often taken as a given by many countries that such people can be detained, and also in the case of asylum seekers in those situations. I think that's an assumption that can be questioned, but in practice I guess it's best questions in the context of alternative arrangements. And I was wondering whether there was any discussion, and even if there wasn't, whether you can give some examples of alternative arrangements that work. I think that would be very useful, not only for all of us present here, but also for the purposes of the final report. I mean, presumably the Mendoza report makes some references to that.
Yes, it does, and I can give it to you afterwards. But whether they work in practice to everyone's satisfaction, I don't know that we can say that, but that we do list what the alternatives are in the resolution.
Mrs. Moore?
Thank you. There's just one very short point, which is when you place somebody in pretrial detention in a criminal context, it has been stated hundreds of times by the European Court of Human Rights that you must not give stereotypical reasons for putting somebody in pretrial detention, that you must examine the specifics of that individual in order to assess whether or not it's justified to deprive him or her of liberty before the trial takes place. And I think it would be very useful if that standard of putting people in pretrial detention could be transferred to putting people in immigration detention, so that you cannot be detained automatically because you're in a certain immigration situation, but there has to be an individual assessment. And that's, of course, in Mrs. Mendonça's excellent report, and she's probably better placed than any of us to answer your question. So perhaps you should buttonhole her at the reception.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much, but that's then at reception. I really would like to thank you all for being here today and participating in the workshops, because I think, and that's ending where I started, but I think it's very important that politicians are really involved in the dialogue with human rights experts and also with the people who work in the daily practice. Because we, the politicians who are here now, they are a member of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, and we have the privilege 4 times a year, and even more at our committee meetings, to deal with human rights. But coming home, I can tell you that's another question. Then you have to explain what you discuss, and you want to bring in all the challenges into your national political daily work, and then you're confronted with a big dilemma. So I think it's more and more needed that also in our national states human rights experts have a very good dialogue with politicians, and at least we have to find a common solution jointly. Thank you very much.
Just to say, I understand the coach will leave from here for the reception in about 20 minutes or so, about 6:30, and that, yes, I was. Thank you for that, because I was going to ask that very question of our secretariat, that we meet tomorrow here for a 9 o'clock start. We have a busy morning, but then the afternoon isn't quite so heavy tomorrow. So we start at 9 o'clock for a workshop on trafficking, exploitation and violence, and the coach for those staying at the Salo Lisboa Hotel will leave at 8:30 a.m. and don't forget to bring your identification badges for the ease of access into the Parliament. Thank you all very much indeed, and thanks to the Secretariat and the interpreters. It's been a long day, and you're all now going to get, I understand, a drink. Thank you.